Good morning.
Morning.
I guess it is still morning. Welcome. This is the last argument in our January 8, 2025 proceedings in this panel of the Court of Appeals. The matter before us now is, I'm going to try to pronounce this. I'll leave it to you to correct my pronunciation if I'm off, but Pioneer versus Seaman.
I believe it's Pioneer.
Pioneer versus Seaman. And it's Seaman. Okay. Thank you for that correction. Notwithstanding the correction, I promise you I'll still mispronounce the names during the course, but at least we know that I'm wrong when I'm doing it. You'll each have 15 minutes to present your argument in this case with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel. Would you like to use that time for rebuttal? Those timing restrictions are indicated in the light and the clock that's in the lectern, so please do remain mindful of those restrictions as you're giving your argument. The lectern can be raised or lowered to match your height for your convenience. There's a button right in front. Please state your name as you commence each of the legs of your argument so we can keep track of who's making the argument for the sake of the public. We do keep a public record audio recording of the proceedings. With that, counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Christopher Bowman here on behalf of appellant Scott Pioneer. This litigation arises from a collision where a Kawasaki UTV driven by appellant was hit by a Mack truck owned and operated by defendant respondent Travis Seaman through Response Trucking Company. Important for this appeal, that collision occurred after Mr. Seaman, and there's no dispute about this, the parties are in full agreement on this, crossed a double yellow center line for the purpose of passing the Kawasaki. That was in violation of Minnesota Statute 169.18 Subdivision 5, specifically paragraph B that says, except in certain circumstances not relevant here, namely a one-way roadway, quote, no vehicle shall, in overtaking and passing another vehicle or at any other time, be driven to the left half of the roadway where, and then there's, I'll skip over some portions, but where official signs are in place prohibiting passing or a distinctive center line is marked. There is no exception in that statute for the road being clear from oncoming traffic. And I should clarify that there's no exception in paragraph B for the road being clear for oncoming traffic. That exception does exist in subparagraph A, that prohibits a vehicle from being driven to the left side of the center of the roadway when overtaking and passing, unless it is safe to do so where it's clear from oncoming traffic.
Can I ask you a question about the effect of Minnesota Statute 169.96? That's the statute, the prima facie evidence of negligence for violating a provision. So I'm just curious about, the statute doesn't refer to the common law, but generally speaking, under the common law, in order for the violation of a statute to constitute negligence per se, or violation of law to constitute negligence per se, it has to be a law, the violation of which is the cause of the injury. Here you've got crossing, a statute that's designed to protect from a specific harm, and that harm was part of the case. In this situation, I'm assuming that crossing a double yellow line is designed for safety reasons, but it's designed to prevent head-on collisions. In this case, we have crossing the double yellow line with the intent being to go around a vehicle that's moving in the same direction. So historically, the violation wouldn't constitute negligence per se, unless it was a head-on collision. It wouldn't matter in a case like this where the intent is to go around the vehicle. Can you address whether the statute implicitly incorporates that prior understanding before the statute, or whether the statute automatically is applicable, you violate a statute, and whether the safety restriction is intended to protect the harm that resulted in this case, is immaterial. And I know I've asked you a very long question. The benefit to you is the marshal so far not started your clock, so it's not going to come against you.
I appreciate your Honor raising that. I was going to, and I promise I wasn't going to try to buy more time, but
it's okay. You got it. You got it.
If I understood your Honor's question, and if I didn't, please let me know, and I'll try to clarify my response. You know, there is a statute. You know, it is appellant's position that the violation of a statute. I recognize that the double yellow line. And no passing zones historically, traditionally are thought of as, you know, you can't, the double yellow line exists in a certain situation where the decision maker, not the court, but the roadway authority, mm-hmm. has determined that there's not sufficient visual space to see in order to pass and avoid oncoming traffic. I don't think that precludes a finding here or precludes application of the statute that 169.96 paragraph B as in boy that talks about violation of any provisions of chapter 169 by either of the parties to such action shall not be negligence but shall be prima facie evidence of negligence. I don't think that 169.69 is explicitly limited to the purpose of, you know, provided that the harm is resulting from the harm that the statute was designed to protect. I do recognize, yes.
Doesn't that seem implicit in this in that sort of regulation?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that the harm clearly has to result from the violation of the statute. There has to be some causal link between the violation of the statute and the harm. That exists here. The collision happened on the left side of the roadway. Had the truck not been on the left side of the roadway, I believe the parties would agree that this collision wouldn't have happened, or at least would not have happened in the way that it did.
I do have a question about that. And we'll hear from, of course, your opposing counsel. But the UTV is traveling down the right-hand shoulder. Is that right? At some point? Yes. Right, like leading up to this? I was wondering exactly this question about, is it crossing the double yellow line or is it just simply hitting the vehicle, whether it had remained in a lane of traffic or over to the left? I don't know if the truck got all the way over into the left-hand lane. What does the evidence tell us about where the collision occurred?
I believe that the collision occurred. At the time that the collision occurred, the Mack truck was entirely to the left of the yellow center line. I hesitated a little bit before saying yes. It was the mule was driving on the shoulder. I believe I'm trying to remember my left and right designation here. The left side tires, the driver's side tires of the mule were on the roadway of the Kawasaki as it was being driven. It was not parked completely to the side of the road. Mr. Semin testified that he needed to move over to the yellow, cross the double yellow line in order to, in his words, safely pass the vehicle. Yes, we would agree that had the Mack truck continued at speed entirely on the right-hand side of the center line, a collision still would have occurred. There was not sufficient room for the truck to continue on in the correct lane of traffic and avoid the mule or avoid the Kawasaki.
Counsel, if I could just follow up, and again, I appreciate hearing from both lawyers on this point, is where the collision occurred. So are you saying that the UTV had crossed the center line at the time of the collision? I'm just confused. If that's where the collision happened on the left side of the road, then wouldn't the UTV have crossed?
The UTV also was on the left side of the center line, or was, if it hadn't fully moved into the left-hand center line, was doing so for the purpose of making a left-hand turn. There was a field to the, I don't know if it was east or west, but to the left of the roadway that the collision occurred on, that the Kawasaki was turning into.
Be the west.
West. Thank you, Your Honor.
No, it would be the east, sorry. It would be the east. They're southbound, to the left is the east.
Importantly, again, the explanation offered by Mr. Semmett is why I had to move over in order to pass the vehicle. But the statute specifically addresses you cannot pass the vehicle. There is a case.
So is there no question of whether a presumption that's of negligence for violation can be rebutted? I thought it was not a question whether the statute's violated, it's whether the presumption of negligence is rebutted.
The presumption of negligence resulting from an admitted violation of the statute, yes, it can be preempted or rebutted, excuse me.
So that's where we should be focusing more so than whether there was a violation, yes or no?
I think both, but both are equal parts.
Is there a dispute that there was a violation of the statute?
I don't think there is.
Okay.
And again, because the explanation is, well, I had to move over to pass, but the statute explicitly prohibits passing. And so the explanation can't be, well, I had to violate the statute because in order to do something that the statute prohibits.
Whether it rebuts a presumption,
yes.
I guess.
There's a case that is cited in respondent's brief, Gerken versus Farmers Elevator, 411 Northwest 2nd, 550 from this court, that talks about how do you rebut that presumption. And in Gerken, I think it's important to note that there was evidence in Gerken that the roadway was dangerous, that the driver, the defendant, I believe it was the defendant, but the individual who had violated the statute had to violate the statute in order to avoid a collision. And the language that is used, excuse me, in that case, that from this court, defendant therefore had a duty to rebut the prima facie case of negligence by establishing some reason why the truck crossed the center line without any negligence on the driver's part. Here, again, the rationale for why it crossed, it wasn't a slippery road condition, and so they had to move over.
Well, the rationale was to go around the utility vehicle.
Correct. The rationale was that Mr. Semin wanted to pass the vehicle.
Right. And so isn't that a fact dispute as to whether he had a reasonable excuse for his conduct? I mean, if he's concerned that continuing in the lane where he is will result in a collision, and so crossing the center line is necessary to avoid a collision, and the jury hears that explanation, why isn't that at least a fact dispute that we don't review after it's resolved by a fact finder?
Because, respectfully, again, Your Honor, the explanation here is that he wanted to pass the vehicle. There's nothing in the record to suggest that he couldn't have simply slowed down, couldn't have taken some other steps to avoid a collision. And this, again, moves into the Rule 60 argument. The record in the evidence was that there were no problems with the brakes. There was no problem with the steering. And so he could. It wasn't a situation that Mr. Semin had tried to avoid a collision, and that the only way to avoid the collision was to move across the double yellow line. Unless the court has any other questions on the negligence per se for violation.
I just want to understand your argument. So
yes.
I think, are you saying then that if the conduct that is the subject of the fact question as to a reasonable excuse is itself conduct that violates the law, that cannot be a reasonable excuse?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there law to support that proposition?
Only the...
I'm thinking about someone runs a red light because they're on the way to the hospital, or there's an emergency. Let's say it's urgent. I've got a family member who's at the hospital. I'm trying to get through. There's no legal justification because no one in my car is in need of getting to the hospital, but I've decided I'm going to run the red light to get to the hospital, to get to my loved one, that's a violation of law. And you're saying that if that is presented to a jury, the jury could not, the jury has to as a matter of law, or the court as a matter of law, has to reject that.
I think that that is still, it, you know, it goes back to the, again, this court's decision in the Gertkin case, that somebody who violates a statute has a duty to rebut the prima facie case by establishing some reason why they did so, other than just choosing to do so.
Right. And in my hypothetical, and in the hypothetical here, there's some argument that a factual dispute as to the reasonableness of violating the statute. And I just want to be clear, your proposition is, as a matter of law, if violating the statute is itself motivated by conduct that is illegal, I'm going to run the red light, I'm going to cross the center line, I'm going to pass when I don't have the authority to pass, you're saying that in and of itself excludes the possibility of rebutting the presumption under the prima facie.
Yeah, yes, that if the conduct, if the explanation is in and of itself unlawful.
Is there some case that supports that, or statutory provision that supports that position?
Not explicitly that I'm aware of, Your Honor. It's based on what we would submit as the logical extension or application of the way that this court has interpreted 169.96, saying you have to have an explanation, and I don't have a case law or statutory cite for this, but that a justification can't be an unlawful justification to then make it lawful. I'm aware. Is the court okay if I take my remaining three
Absolutely.
Minutes?
Absolutely. It's your minutes. mindful that you got a couple of extra at the beginning, so.
I want to address very, very quickly the Rule 60 issue. Here we have a situation further complicating this case is after trial, after the post-trial motions had, the initial post-trial motions had been filed, appellant learned that Mr. Simmons' discovery responses and deposition testimony and trial testimony had been, or discovery responses specifically, had been somewhat less than accurate. And the district court importantly agreed that Mr. Simmons was evasive in his discovery responses, failing to disclose certain conversations that he had had regarding the CVI. And I apologize as I stand here. My mind is drawing a blank on what CVI stands for.
I think it's commercial vehicle.
Yeah. Commercial vehicle inspection. Thank you.
But wasn't that information in the police report that was available to your client?
The information in the police report indicated that the vehicle had been towed for a CVI inspection to be performed. The results of that CVI inspection were not in the police report. Mr. Simmons' conversation with Inspector Forster, who performed the CVI, were not in the police report.
But as a matter of due diligence, I mean, an individual sees, oh, there's been an investigation about the vehicle, and there may be some mechanical issue that might have contributed to the collision, like faulty brakes, for example. Why isn't that enough to trigger the duty for due diligence?
I think then we get into what constitutes due diligence is a significant element of the dispute here. Mr. Simmons was asked in discovery, identify any conversations you had with anybody. He did not disclose that he had spoken with Inspector Forster. Provide any documents you have related to this.
Was he ever asked provide the CVI?
He was. Not explicitly what provide the CVI report performed after the collision. No, that question was not asked, but that wasn't, the CVI is clearly encompassed by both interrogatories and discovery requests. There was a lot of discussion at the district court about.
Right, but that goes to whether it should have been turned over. But the question now, I think, is about due diligence. assuming that it should have been turned over and wasn't, was it discoverable? Did your client exercise due diligence in trying to get at the document? And it seems to me one of the questions would bearing upon that is, was there notice that it existed, and the police report would suggest so? And then the next question is, what was done in order to try to get the CVI by your client in time for trial?
I see even my expired time is answered. has expired. Can I answer?
You certainly may.
For that, we direct the court to the Eighth Circuit's decision in Edgar versus Finley that discusses due diligence and the case law, which I recognize is primarily in the family law context, that talks about how a party has a right to assume that sworn answers are correct and aren't untruthful. And isn't penalized for that. That's from this court's decision, Turner versus Suggs.
Right. So if the defendant were asked the question, was there a CVI? There was a CVI referenced in the police report. Do you have access to that? Did it bear upon did it suggest any equipment violations? If the answer were no, I think that would fit the case law that you're describing better than this circumstance. It seems to me.
May I respond? and here there was a question of, you know, was there anything wrong with the brakes? Was there anything wrong with the vehicle? And the response was that the vehicle was in 100% working condition.
Thank you. So, you will have 5 minutes.
Thank you.
An additional question? I bet Brad Bold, I didn't know if you were about to ask a question.
Yeah, no, I'm good.
Okay.
Yeah,
thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Giesen. I represent respondent Travis Semin. Mr. Semin asked this court to affirm the jury's verdict. There was sufficient evidence for the jury to excuse his centerline crossing, for the district court to give the look no see instruction, and for the jury's damages finding. Further, the court should affirm Judge Long's careful analysis on the Rule 60 motion.
On the first point, can you address the argument that 169.96, the necessity or the reasonable excuse cannot be to break the law?
The law given to the jury was the standard jury instruction 65.25, and I'll note that nothing in that jury instruction, which was originally objected to on different grounds that aren't particularly clear, but certainly not being objected to now. So given that standard jury instruction, which is here before the court without any challenge, has nothing in there about how the basis of the law needs to be, frankly, I don't necessarily understand the position being made that if you are breaking the no passing zone rule, you can't be not pass. Basically, the position I believe that's being offered would swallow the rule and essentially transform every traffic violation into negligence per se.
No, I don't necessarily think so. I mean, the argument is if the excuse that you're giving is itself of an intent to violate the law, I mean, it's not if the excuse were he's on the shoulder, he swerved in my lane, and quickly to avoid a collision, I crossed the center line, that would be different from the position of your client, which is the articulated reason is I want it to pass him, which is a violation of the law, as opposed to I wanted to avoid a collision, which in itself is not a motivation to violate the law. The purpose is different.
I think I understand Your Honor's point. I think that goes to the reasonableness of the excuse being offered. For example, in your example, if the excuse was, hey, I'm hurrying, I would like to get around you in a no-passing zone, not a particularly reasonable excuse, and I don't think a jury would likely agree with that. On the other hand, the Gertkin case that's being cited says this is a question of fact for jurors to apply their common sense, life experience to decide whether the excuse being proffered is consistent with due care.
Mr. Bowman wasn't aware of any, but are you aware of any cases that get to the heart of that question that I'm asking, which is whether a reasonable excuse can be to do something that is itself illegal? Is there any case law on the point?
I did not find any. I believe there's also the second part of the standard jury instruction, which our position is the law of the case. It's not only whether there's a reasonable excuse or justification. It could also be that your violation was not, a reasonable person could think that the violation of that traffic statute would not endanger anybody that the statute was intended to protect. And to the court's discussion earlier about, and this was a position we took in our brief, the no passing zone provision is to protect against head-on collisions. It is not to protect against broadsiding someone who would be illegally crossing two lanes of traffic from one side of the road to a ditch on the other side of the road. There's no evidence that, and frankly, that would be a jury question as well. I mean,
Perhaps so. On the other hand, if, imagine a car traveling, I think it sounds like the facts of this case, a car traveling southbound in a two-lane divided highway, there's a car in front, and an illegal pass is occurring where you have a double crossing of the double yellow line to get around a car, but that car is now about to make a quick left-hand turn. I think the double yellow line would be, if you're about to make the left-hand turn, you can assume that no one is trying to pass you because that would be unlawful. So although I think the double yellow line is intended to protect against head-on collisions, there are some circumstances at an intersection, arguably like this case, where the double yellow line also protects against left-turning traffic. Do you agree with that or not?
I think it could, under some circumstances, be reasonable to assume that that double yellow line is protecting against somebody from passing. This is not an intersection, though. This is and there's pictures of this. The exhibits are in the record. This is a ditch on the other side of the road, and I think there's reference to it being a field drive. I can't see the field drive in the pictures. It's really a field on across the side of the road. But again, I think this is all, to your point, this is circumstantial. These are the circumstances and all of the various considerations that the jurors in Rice County considered and weighed and came to a decision to absolve Mr. Semin from being negligent under these circumstances. And I want to be absolutely clear that, you know, even if you were to say that the violation of law can't be itself the excuse, I don't think that's an accurate portrayal of what Mr. Semin's testimony actually was. Again, I'd remind the court of the standard review. The record needs to be looked at in a light favorable to the verdict. Mr. Semin testified, quote, "I took that as a sign of recognition of me being behind him on the highway, knowing that I was there and virtually stopping to allow me to go around him," end quote. And that's at page 186 of the transcript. What actually happened here is that Mr. Semin sees Mr. Pinier driving down Geneva Avenue, and what happens is that Mr. Pinier looks back, makes eye contact with Mr. Semin as he's approaching, going under the speed limit. At that point, Mr. Pinier slows down even more after having looked at Mr. Semin. And Mr. Semin's testimony was, "I thought he saw me because he was looking at me, and then he, if not stopped, pretty much was stopped on the side of the road. So at that point, I wanted to go around him."
And can you just, on the side of the road, you mean off toward, partly at least, on the shoulder?
Yes, and there's pictures of Geneva Avenue. It's a pretty narrow shoulder. I think it's, and I don't have feet. There was no accident reconstruction done, so there's not, I can't give you exact figures, but the pictures will show you and give a sense of what the jury saw. There's not a big shoulder, but he was on the shoulder, and he, in our position, he crossed two lanes of traffic, both the southbound lane and the northbound lane, in an attempt to get to the field on the other side of the road.
So when your client saw, the testimony, your client's testimony is when he saw the vehicle, it was pulled over slightly off the road at least, and that's when he saw the look back.
Yep, the sequence, according to Mr. Semin, and it's in our brief, is, and again, I'll quote, "He moved across the center line because Pinier had slowed down even more, looked over his shoulder at Mr. Semin, virtually came to a stop," and this is a quote as to what Mr. Semin testified to the jury, quote, "That's when I decided it was safe to move over to allow space between myself and him to go around him." So this isn't a situation, even if it could be negligent for somebody to simply be going down the route, decide I don't want to follow the no passing, well, those rules are for other people, I'd just like to go around somebody. Not the case before the court. This is a situation where Mr. Pinier looked back and was, in a reasonable view from Mr. Semin was, hey, I took that as a sign, go around me. Now, the position now is you have to basically tailgate somebody who is on the side of the road, makes eye contact with you, and you have to stop there and wait for them to do something. maybe that could be a reasonable position. I don't think it is. You may not think it is, but ultimately it's the jury's.
You wouldn't necessarily have to tailgate. You just would follow right behind the car. Or, in this case, UTV.
I think what that would raise another. I mean, one of the jury instructions the jury also received is you can't stop on a highway. That in itself is a danger, to just be parked on a highway. So that's why, regardless of, you could be cited, have a ticket for certain violations, but the legislature said that it's not negligence to violate a traffic statute. It's evidence of negligence only. And when there's evidentiary questions, it's for the jury to resolve, weighing all the considerations and circumstances, be able to hear the testimony, see how people testify, look them in the eyes, and see, is this a reasonable decision? Would I move over for somebody, apply their own life experience and common sense? That's what the jury did here.
What does the verdict imply or state about Mr. Pinier's own negligence?
100%. And there was, that's not, I think the only basis.
Can we infer, what can we infer, I guess, about the, I recognize the jury decision, but is there some factual scenario that we then can infer occurred in the jury's mind in light of in the light most favorable to your client?
The jury, the court can infer, looking at the evidence in the light favorable to the verdict and seeing if there's any basis to sustain it, is that the jury heard that Mr. Pinier failed to signal, was in an ATV, did not see a dump truck behind him, testified that there was a mirror in these pictures that nobody could see, despite being, the jury was basically told to take him at his word that there in these pictures there was a mirror that wasn't there, and ultimately made a left-hand turn without any notice or 10 feet notice. The testimony is a bit shaky, and that it was 100% Mr. Semmons' fault. That's what the jury heard. The jury rejected it, and that was their province to do so. Just briefly on the look-no-see instruction, I'll note that, again, this is not a challenge that the look-no-see instruction is inconsistent with current law. It is a position that there was no evidence that the dump truck was in plain view. That is simply not true. I think the piece that's being missed, just to have one point on that, is Mr. Pinier's own statement to Mr. Semmons after the accident. And Mr. Semmons' quote on that was, "I even looked back and I didn't see you coming." That's what Mr. Semmons testified that Mr. Pinier told him after the accident.
You don't dispute that there were damages that Mr. Pinier suffered?
No, and the jury was told that. Mr. Benner, my colleague, if you read his closing argument, it starts right with that. Let's start with what we can agree on. There were damages. He had a broken pelvis and he missed work. On the other hand, Mr. Benner then went on and said, but you should look, according to the exhibits that were submitted by Mr. Carlson, Mr. Pinier's trial counsel, you should see what's actually being owed. And those exhibits were not redacted. And that is invited error and is not a basis for to create an evidentiary issue to then seek a reversal on an issue that you created. That's not allowed. In any event, just as Judge Long found, that issue is not necessary to reach because there's longstanding case law that it's harmless error. Any kind of perversity with the damages finding is harmless given the liability finding that Mr. Pinier was 100% negligent. Finally on this, if I have a few minutes left to talk about the Rule 60 motion, our position has been that that is a pivot that came after the seminal issue in this case happened, was all about what happened in those few seconds on Geneva Avenue when the Mr. Semmons moved across the center line to, in his view, safely go around a nearly stopped vehicle who had made eye contact with him. It is only after that verdict came down that there was interest in the CVI. And I still have not heard, I think there's agreement that this is abuse of discretion review as to whether there should be a new trial granted. And I still haven't heard the actual dispute with the district court's findings on this point as to why the court was denying the motion. And again, I think it's not only that the accident report refers to the CVI, it's that Mr. Semmons was asked about the CVI at his deposition, or excuse me, not asked about the CVI, but asked about the accident report without any kind of discussion about it. The other point I'd like to make is that there was a request, document request, for post-accident maintenance records that was objected to as irrelevant. And there was no further follow-up. apparently both parties thought that this particularly wasn't relevant because this was an operation issue. It was not a maintenance issue. It was whether the decision to cross the center line was reasonable or not, about maintenance.
Perhaps so, but one argument could have been if the evidence had been plaintiff's hands that contributing to the collision may have been an inability to slow the truck down enough to avoid the collision, and that is it could be based upon this faulty brake issue identified in the inspection. Is that not so?
I think that could have been a theory that was pursued timely had plaintiff's counsel done that. It just wasn't, and that's where everything was focused on.
I think the argument is if the CVI had been available, then that would be an argument that would have been likely pursued.
And the CVI was available, and I think the position told to the district court was that it was subpoenaed from an officer, Sergeant Peterson, and that just wasn't true. It wasn't subpoenaed. There was no specific request for the CVI report. I think you heard counsel say that there was some interrogatory about tell us about everything you discuss with anybody, and it's those kind of questions. It's not fair to say that that's fraud because we couldn't really understand what they were asking about. It was about, you know, who turned when, and I think that really does distinguish. Is it the Edgar case? There's an Eighth Circuit case being cited. It's apples and oranges. I think Judge Long's decision on that is carefully reasoned. She gives an explanation. She goes through all of the different arguments. Again, it's just like the jury is responsible for making fact findings, weighing all the reasonableness, balancing the facts and different arguments. Same thing with this abuse of discretion review. The district court is in the best position. And I point that this appendix is fairly thick. Included in there are a lot of different orders, decisions in which Judge Long was able to see how diligent counsel was. There's plaintiff failed to disclose any experts, for example, and there was a motion limiting on that. There was other examples. The point being is simply that Judge Long was in the position to make that ruling. I see that my time's expired. We are asking the court to affirm.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Again, for the record, Christopher Bowman for appellant.
Thank you.
There was a reference in respondent's argument that this was a pivot. And Judge Ross, I think you hit the nail right on the head. Was maintenance an issue at the trial? No, it wasn't. The trial focused on, to use Mr. Giesen's words, the few seconds immediately before the accident, or the minutes immediately preceding the accident. But that was because there was no evidence in the record at that point of improper maintenance because Mr. Semin had failed to disclose it. There was a reference in the argument that they had a hard time understanding interrogatories. There was no objection to any of the interrogatories, and the interrogatories are not as broad and vague as Mr. Giesen has indicated. Interrogatory number 7. Identify any photographs, slides, motion pictures, videotapes, plats, drawings, models, charts, or other physical demonstrative or illustrative evidence relating to this case. The CVI related to this case, it was not disclosed. Mr. Semin has also made...
Well, if there were motions in limine to exclude the effort to get documents or inspections after the fact... Why wouldn't the defendant be in a position to make the reasonable conclusion that this is not responsive to that interrogatory, that the CVI is not responsive to that interrogatory?
Those motions in limine did not address the CVI. It addressed certain issues that, frankly, are not relevant to this appeal. Judge Rossi, you also raised, couldn't this have been pled as an alternative theory? I would also note that the steering issue took the truck out of service. It was an out-of-service violation, and there's testimony from Inspector Forster in the companion case, the Lemieux action, that was introduced as exhibits to the Rule 60 motion, in fact, by respondent, saying... Yes, if there's an out-of-service violation, the truck shouldn't be driven. It should be taken somewhere and repaired. It should not be operated on a roadway like Mr. Simmons was operating it. I also want to talk very briefly.
I assume that you're correct on the relevancy of the CVI. Do you have anything more to add as to the due diligence issue that would also be dispositive on appeal?
The due diligence, again, it is our position that Mr. Semin was asked to produce or to ask to identify these documents. The record is a little unclear. At one point, Mr. Semin indicated that neither he nor his counsel had the CVI until January of 2024, about a year ago, when the Rule 60 motion came up.
What's the most specific request that you believe was made to require the disclosure of the CVI?
Of the CVI, and can we, would it be okay with the court if I expanded that to include the identity of Inspector Forster and the discussion that Mr. Semin had with Inspector Forster?
CVI is the issue. I mean, I think the argument is that, I think on appeal, that there was a failure to produce the CVI, that matters. So I think that's the focus of the appeal.
The CVI report itself is very important. I don't mean to diminish that, but also included in that is the discussion that Mr. Forster had with Mr. Semin, where they discussed, among other things, the out of service violation. That is recorded in the CVI.
Well, you can answer as to either then. Either
all right. Both, specifically, it would be interrogatory 7 that asked for physical, demonstrative, or illustrative evidence, and that's on page 20 of 105 of Mr. Carlson's declaration, which I believe is docket 183. I may be a little bit off on that. It's in the 180s. And on the next page, page 21 of 105, interrogatory number 12, asking to fully relate in as much detail as you can recall all conversations that took place at the time prior to or following the occurrence referred to in Plant's complaint, where Mr. Semin identifies that he spoke to Mr. Panure, spoke with Mrs. Panure, spoke who he has since learned to be Mary Lemieux, and then also spoke to Deputy Peterson. Inspector Forster is not referenced. I do see my time has expired. So with that, we'd ask the court to reverse and remand for proceedings not inconsistent with this court's opinion.
Well,
thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bowman and Mr. Giesen. Well presented, nicely done. Both clients should be very happy with your representation. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. And that is the last case on our oral calendar for today, so the court is in recess. Thank you.
Thank you. All rise.